I don't know. Is Paki offensive in the US? Because I actually don't know.
Actually, Paki, in my experience, we don't find it very offensive in the US. But in the UK, I know it's considered an extremely derogatory term for Pakistanis. But over here, you have basically the only people who even say Paki are Pakistanis. Like, I love Paki food, but most people don't even say Paki.
So just a brief history. When people from South Asia first came to the UK, and whether you were Bengali, Pakistani, Indian, even if you were Egyptian, as long as you looked brown, you would get called a Paki. And they would essentially, there was a thing called Paki bashing, where they were like 30-year-old, like just a bunch of hooligan skinheads, yeah, would just chase any brown person they saw and jump them. I remember my dad telling me stories about, he had met people that when they were in school, as soon as school finished, they would have to run home. Because if they didn't run home as soon as the bell went, then they were going to get rushed and got the shit beaten out of them.
Assalamu alaikum, hello, adab, and welcome back to Puckboard. This episode is a major milestone for us. 50 episode hamare pure ho gaye hain. Aaj, I started this Puckboard podcast about 1.5 years ago, and now we are at 50 episodes with 60 different guests from the US, UK, UAE, Canada, France, Spain, Hong Kong, Germany, and of course, Pakistan. This podcast has been a superb adventure for me to be able to speak to Pakistanis all over the world and bring their voices to you. And the feedback, emails, and messages I get every single week are what keep us going. And we love that you enjoy these talks. As usual, there's a lot of dilchasp content planned ahead. So stay with us and subscribe. Okay, now let's go ahead and talk to today's guest.
My name is Mohammed Akhil Ghani. I am 18 years old and I go by the name Akhil because, number one, practically because, you know, there's a lot of Muhammads out there. And number two, sort of the reason my parents give is that they scold me a lot, so they don't want to be scolding the Prophet's name, so they decide to call me by my middle name instead.
Akhil Ghani is today's guest, 18 years old, British Pakistani, brought up in Southeast London. Many of you might be wondering, what is life like for youngsters who are born and raised abroad, have Pakistani parents, but are not surrounded by a Pakistani community? Akhil gives us some insight into that. He was born in England, grew up in Beckenham, which, as he describes, is the whitest town in the whitest borough of London, and had no Pakistani peers in most of his school life. Naturally, that situation for Akhil and many others can bring about an identity crisis, a phenomenon that we've discussed with many guests so far. It's quite a theme in those Pakistanis living abroad. Prior to recording this episode, Akhil wrote to me, "I used to dislike being Pakistani, but as I've learned more about our history and culture, I think I've finally begun to accept who I am." So for the first 30 minutes of this podcast, Akhil shares his life with us, with several personal stories thrown in. After that, Akhil shares with us some information about his older brother, Adil, who is physically disabled. In fact, in our next episode, we will talk to Adil directly himself to get his firsthand account of his life and disability. So let's get started.
Yeah, and so basically I'm currently studying A-levels at Harris Westminster, which is a school in central London. And I live in Southeast London in a town called Beckenham, which is pretty much, I would say, the whitest area in the whole of London. Because London is quite a diverse place, but then our town is like just this blob of gore, just like in the middle of nowhere.
Not a lot of Desis around.
Yeah, not a lot of Desis. Basically, we're the only Desis here.
So why did they settle down over there? Why do you and your family live there?
Yeah, so essentially what it was is, so I was born in Essex, Chelmsford, and we were put here by the government because my older brother's disabled and we need like a house that is accommodating to that. And so they built this house, when they were building this sort of block of houses, they made this house like disability friendly, and then we were put here basically.
Got it. Yeah, so we'll get a little bit more into that. Were you born in Pakistan?
I was born, like I said, I was born in Essex, Chelmsford.
And have you been to Pakistan?
Yes, I've been to Pakistan twice. Once when I was a baby, which I just can't remember. And then one when I was about 12 for like a wedding.
Yeah, when was the most recent time?
So, yeah, so when I was 12, we sort of went there for my mum's cousin's wedding. We were like the, what's the, my oldest is not very good in it. So the, what's it, Dulia? You know that... When the groom has like the two bodyguards or whatnot.
The two bodyguards? Really? No, I don't even know that.
It's not like bodyguards. It's like basically
the guys who come with him.
Usually, like if a guy's getting married, his sister's sons would like be, I guess, bodyguards. You could say.
Oh, like a serbala.
I don't know.
I know there's a serbala. That's what they often call him. Like a serbala is a guy who kind of dresses up like the groom. He's usually a kid, actually.
Yeah. So me and my younger brother were that. We were both serbalas.
Oh, serbala. Yeah.
Yeah, we were called Dulian or something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we were that. We were sort of chilling in Pakistan for that wedding. And so we sort of kind of like, I guess, VIPs in a sense, because we just went wherever the bride and groom went.
Yeah.
Pakistan was interesting. I'd probably say, because I went a while back, and you know, a lot has changed in the last, I would say, year basically. You know, 2019 was a good year for Pakistan, a bad year for India, but a really good year for us. Because, you know, sort of public, like publicity wise, I think in the last year, the whole perception of Pakistan has definitely significantly improved.
Hmm. Yeah, it has. You're right. Yeah. And the whole news about Pakistan being such a great country for travel and tourism, right? It's increasing.
Yeah, number one destination 2020, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, now speaking of that, you mentioned in your notes, right? So there was a kind of a transition that you went through regarding Pakistani culture, about how you felt about Pakistani culture before. And, you know, you weren't really very accepting of it, but now you've gotten a lot more, like you feel a lot more Pakistani. So talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So like I said, I've grown up in probably the whitest town in London. And that's probably the reason why I kind of, not necessarily hated, but I would say sort of rejected my sort of Pakistani heritage, mainly to fit in. You know, I was the only brown kid, and so naturally I would just pretend I was just like everyone else, in a sense. But obviously, you know, I have brown skin, so it didn't really work. So I did get a lot of, I wouldn't call it bullying. You could call it bullying, but I wouldn't use that term because I think that implies like some sort of proper, like organized attack on someone. Whereas this was just sort of teasing and, you know, you're Pakistani, Osama bin Laden, all of this and that.
So feeling like an outcast, basically.
Yeah, basically feeling like an outcast. And, you know, it's weird to me because I was born after 9/11. I was born November 2001. So all of that, I basically for my whole life, I've never known a time when Muslims were seen as, you know, just regular people.
Mm.
I've always experienced that, you know, Muslims are terrorists, all of this and that, you know.
You know, like one of our recent episodes that we pushed out was with a guy, much older guy. His name is Ali Rizvi.
Yeah, I listened to that one.
Yeah, you probably listened to it. So he and I were talking about 9/11 and the fact that both of us were born before 9/11. So we were old enough to know what's going on. And I talked to a lot of guys who are like you, born after 2001 or on 2001, but after 9/11, or even born before 2001, but like 97, 98, right? So they weren't old enough to understand what's going on. Those perspectives are so interesting because, you know, I can't imagine seeing it from your eyes, because for me, this was kind of a transition. Like before 9/11, everything was normal. And after 9/11, the entire world's perception of Muslims kind of changed.
Yeah. And that's what's normal for us, you know. You know, constantly growing up, I was like the only Muslim kid in any of my classes. And in my entire year group, there was only about 4 Muslim kids, right? And so I would constantly have to, I felt as though I was representing all Muslims and I had to sort of put my best foot forward. But also there was the aspect of, you don't want to act too Muslim. You know, you don't want to be like, say, assalamu alaikum loudly when you're on the phone to your parents or whatnot. You try and sort of, you know, acknowledge you are that, but you're not.
You're not over the top, yeah.
Yeah, you're not over the top, basically. And I'll probably say, you know, I'm not even that religious. You know, religion, although, you know, it's important, I believe in that there's one God, but I'll probably say I'm still sort of learning about God. Because I'm only 18, right? And I'm still in that process of discovery. So, you know, it's not like I'm, you know, like the perfect example of what a Muslim is or whatever. You know, I'm still trying to learn.
Yeah, makes sense. So what got you then more accepting? Was there a certain trigger or a certain thing that happened to you that kind of made you realize that, hey, I need to embrace Islam or Pakistan a little bit more?
Yeah, so I was basically a coconut. I'm just going to say it. I was just a coconut, essentially. I didn't know anything about Pakistani culture other than... Okay, so how do I explain this? Because my family is sort of the only Pakistanis in our area.
Yeah.
And we don't sort of see Pakistanis that much apart from like family members that come to visit. My exposure to things like Urdu, things like Pakistani music, Pakistani movies and whatnot have sort of been very limited. Not saying that I haven't experienced those things, you know, we listened to Pakistani music and whatnot, but I just didn't like feel a connection to it, you know, because in school, you know, we're taught. Okay, basically, I will tell you this story, right? So my mum, she, with my older two siblings, she would speak to them in Urdu.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's how they learn Urdu. But when me and my younger brother came around, I know this sounds really bad, but taking what we learned in school and applying that at home, I used to turn around to my mum and go, whenever my mum spoke to me in Urdu, I would turn around and go, "Oh, mum, we're in England. You have to speak English." You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The thing is, back then, I just thought there was nothing wrong with it. But looking back, I was probably like, that's really right-wing freaking, you know, what they say, innit? That's literally what, like, things like the EDL say. Oh, you're in England, you have to speak English.
Yeah. What did your mom say to that?
My mom, she, to be honest, it's kind of sad. I kind of wish she stayed speaking Urdu to us, but she just started learning, like, speaking to English to us. And so now I'm basically, when it comes to Urdu, I understand all of it. I can understand it when people speak it to me, but I just can't speak it back.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's sort of one thing I'm very guilty about, because had I been more accepting of who I was or my identity or whatnot, I would probably be a well more rounded person today, but I wasn't. So, you know, it is what it is. It's sad, but I can't change it. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I hear you. You know, it's funny. My mom and I, because we migrated to this country, right? The US. Our perception was very different. I was always expected to speak Urdu at home. And if I told my mom, you know, this is America, you speak English here, I would have a juti flying at my face immediately after that. My mom, like, she always established this rule. And then she doesn't know English that well, you know? She knows basic English that she learned over time, but she didn't grow up here. She didn't spend a substantial amount of time here in her younger age. So she could never speak English to us. So there was always this expectation, you got to speak Punjabi or Urdu at home.
Yeah. The thing with my parents is, so my dad migrated to the UK when he was 10 years old in 1977. And he didn't know a word of English, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was put into school. This is a story he likes to tell me, right? About how he basically came here for us. And so he put into school at the age of 10, didn't know a word of English. And he was at the bottom class. And so there were like seven classes. He was in the seventh class right at the bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
By the end of school, he had finished at like top class. And then he went on to do A-levels. Mm-hmm. And then he went to like Imperial College, which is like one of the top universities in the world. Obviously, my dad knows English very well. He knows Punjabi, he knows Urdu. So he's always spoken to us, in me and my younger brother, especially in English. Whereas my mum, who migrated here after she married my dad when she was 21, she at home always spoke Urdu to my older siblings, but she didn't fully become fluent in English until after I turned around and go, "Mum, this is England. You have to speak English." Yeah. So my mum's not really. My mum doesn't get affected by little things like this, and so she just went and rolled with it. So it's like, okay, I'll just speak English to them, innit?
Right.
And even, I think she said, "Oh, it's good that you made me speak English, because now I'm much better at speaking English." Whereas I feel guilty about it because I can't speak Urdu. So now I got this thing with my mum where I try and tell her, "Mum, you speak to me in English and I'll respond in Urdu." You know?
Yeah, that's a good way to learn. Yeah.
I'm starting to learn now. I'm getting better every day, I guess, but still.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think you find over time that, you know, forgetting about how we kind of sometimes grow up thinking our own culture, our own background is kind of backwards, right? Putting that aside, but just the fact that you can learn two languages or be bi or trilingual, it adds a lot of dimensions to your personality and, you know, just a lot more flavor in your experience, I feel like. So, like, I've been exposed to not just Urdu, Punjabi at home and English outside of home, of course, but I also try to, like, take a stab at a few other languages. I tried French in high school.
Yeah, I did French as well.
I tried Arabic in college. Yeah. I had this weeb phase where I tried to learn Japanese a little bit while I was watching anime. Like when I was around your age, like 16, 17, 18. So I've been exposed to various languages and it's fun.
Because the thing with different languages is because language is it's not only just, you know, a means of communication.
Yeah.
When you can speak a language, you know, you can engage with the history of those people. You can engage with the culture of those people.
It's yeah.
Not like, for example, you know, if I read a history book on Pakistan and it's in English, right? Or I read a history book about South Asia and it's in English, it won't have the same emotional, I guess, impact as if I read it in those people's own native language, because they would tell their side of the story. It's like the whole idea of when we look at ancient Greece or ancient Egypt, all our documents are from the ancient Greek people, right? And so we only ever get Herodotus said this, but we never hear about what the Egyptians or the Persians were saying because we don't have their texts or whatnot, or they're not well known, you know?
Yeah, exactly right. There's a part of the world that isn't exposed to us as much when you're in Western education.
Yeah.
You know, Western academic settings there. You know, we hear a lot about Greek philosophers, for example. And Roman philosophers, we don't hear a lot about, well, the philosophers of the Middle East, the poets of the Middle East. For example, for me, you know, knowing Punjabi was kind of, and even Urdu, was kind of opening a door to a whole different world of these amazing poets. And it was only then that I started realizing that English poetry is actually not so great. It's not a very poetic language.
Yeah, it's really not. Like, I'll probably say the best works, like Shakespeare, I would say it's decent. It's decent, but, you know, I wouldn't go and watch a Shakespearean play, you know?
That's the funny thing. Shakespeare is kind of a revered icon for us, right? Both in the UK and the US.
We learn
Shakespeare. It's almost mandatory in high school for us.
It's mandatory for us as well.
I've read several Shakespeare plays. I've actually acted in a Julius Caesar in high school. We had to wear togas and everything.
Yeah, I acted in what's it called? Hamlet. Hamlet, that's the one.
Hamlet. Yeah, yeah. So they really pound that into you, right? Your English teachers here really, really try to get that into your system that this guy, Shakespeare, you know, he's everything. What should you call it? The epitome of the English language.
Not even just the English language, but just the epitome of just world culture. That's how they do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, like there's never been a bigger tragedy than Romeo and Juliet or Julius Caesar, you know. But in reality, it's like any Pakistani drama has like the same amount of tragedies going on with a little bit more emotion.
I think even probably more tragedies, to be honest.
Even more tragedies. Yeah.
I think that goes back to sort of my upbringing here. So basically what happened was, I went to school in Beckenham, primary school.
Mm-hmm.
So in the UK, you have this thing called the Harris Federation, which is like a federation of different schools. And you have Harris Academy, Beckenham, Harris Academy, Peckham, Harris Academy, Bermondsey, all these different places that have Harris Academies.
Hmm.
Essentially like privatized education, essentially. It's still, you do the government curriculum, but the government has paid this company, which is Harris Academy, to do it for us. And so... Yeah, so I went to Harris Academy, Beckenham, and this was a school that was, I would say, around 40% black, black kids, sort of African kids and Jamaican kids from like the Caribbean. They sort of came from other towns, sort of like Penge and whatnot around the local area. And then probably around 59% white, and then sort of 1% other, essentially. And I was one of those others. I think that's sort of why I said I had a rejection of Pakistani culture, because I was put in a position where if I didn't fit in, then I would ultimately get picked on. And I did, you know, people would take the mick at me being, like I said, Osama bin Laden. There was this one time where I was standing in the line to go into lunch, and this kid, he comes up to me and he says, "Hey, Akil, I heard they did 9/11 to celebrate your birthday." Yeah. Now, first of all, I was born, like, let's just analyze that for a minute. Yeah, I was born in November, so that's 2 months after 9/11. So either they got a bit too excited and wanted to celebrate early, you know, I don't know. It's a stupid comment to make, basically. And so he said that to me, and I'm not going to lie, the way I reacted, I regret it, but I essentially tried to fight him in the line. And so I was throwing like kicks and punches and trying to hit him. And yeah, he hit me with one good punch around the head, and that really sort of, you know, that really hurt. And I luckily the teacher stepped in and stopped it. It even happened again, you know, before I took my GCSEs, which are like our final exams before we take our A-levels, which are our other final exams before we go to uni. And so,
yeah,
like the week before GCSEs, right, there was sort of this drama going around about the word Paki, okay? I'm sure you've, I don't know, is Paki offensive in the US? Because I actually, I don't know.
Actually, Paki is, in my experience, we don't find it very offensive in the US. But in the UK, I know it's considered an extremely derogatory term for Pakistanis. But over here, you have, basically, the only people who even say Paki are Pakistanis. Like, I love Paki food, but most people don't even say Paki.
Yeah, because in the UK, so just a brief history, when people from South Asia first came to the UK and they would go to, they were invited here by the UK government after, you know, the World War to come help rebuild the country or whatnot. And so, you know, then you had loads of South Asians come, including like my grandfather, he also came. And they were, whether you were Bengali, Pakistani, Indian, even if you were Egyptian, as long as you looked brown, you would get called a Paki. And they would essentially, there was a thing called Paki bashing where they were like 30-year-old, like just a bunch of hooligan skinheads, would just chase any brown person they saw and jump them. You know, I remember my dad telling me stories about he knew people, or he had met people that when they were in school, as soon as school finished, they would have to run home, because if they didn't run home as soon as the bell went, then they were going to get rushed and got the shit beaten out of them. And whenever these things happened, it was always the word Paki being used. There's often this argument, right, that, oh, Paki is just short for Pakistani, I would say it doesn't really apply, because if you went to Pakistan, you know, I doubt they'll be saying, oh, I'm a Paki. You know, we didn't get to choose that as our abbreviation. It was imposed upon us by racist hooligans, right? Whereas things like Brit, for example, Brit is short for people like British, Brit. You know, that's the thing that we use. It doesn't have the racial, you know, history behind that word, the racially charged significance of that word. And also, if someone calls you a Paki, right, how are they going to know you're a Paki? For example, like when someone sees me and they call me a Paki, they're not calling me a Paki because they know I'm from Pakistan. They're calling me a Paki because I look brown, right?
Right. So it's kind of this broad term that they just use for anybody.
Yeah, it's just a racist word. And so sort of when I was in school, it was known that this is a racist word. You don't say it. In sort of like the wider society of Britain. It was like frowned upon. Even Prince Harry said it one time and, you know, he got grilled for it. But he sort of said it in an interview. He was like, he was talking about when he was in the army and his friend who was from Pakistan, he was like, oh, my Paki friend or something like that. It wasn't that serious. Yeah. He was just ignorant. He didn't know. So I don't blame him for that. But so in this school, right, when I was in school, there was like this big drama, you know, going on. Is the word Paki offensive? And me being pretty much the only Pakistani in my year, you know, I had to, I felt as though I had the verdict on this, right? I felt as though, you know, whatever I say would be the last word on it. So I was trying to explain to people that this word is offensive, and people just didn't take me seriously. They were like, oh, you're just trying to create your own N-word or whatever. And I understand that, you know, the N-word has a very long history of racism and, you know, colonialism attached to it that the word Paki doesn't have. You know, the word Paki is only like 70 years old, whereas the word, you know, the N-word goes back, you know, hundreds of years. And so, you know, it's not, I know it's not the same, but it's still offensive. And so I was trying to explain to these kids it's offensive, right? And now we're sitting in class. What happens is this one kid, he turns to me, he turns to me and he goes, Akil, why do you think the word Paki is offensive? And so I'm trying to explain to him, yeah, it is and whatnot. And then he goes and tells this other kid, he goes to this other kid and says, hey, yo, I dare you to say Paki to Akil, yeah, see what he does. And so this kid, yeah, he gets a bit excited and then he turns to me and he's like, oh, you mean Paki, right? Yeah, he says Paki, and that's it. I was like, you know what? I've tried to explain to these people it's offensive. They're not listening to words. And so now, you know, I got to get physical. And so I sort of grabbed him. I grabbed him. We sort of stood up and I threw him against the wall. And I started to like punch him and stuff. The teachers broke it up and we were taken to see like, you know, one of the senior leaders in our school or whatnot. and like senior membership, senior staff member, right? This staff member, he's my French teacher. He was of African descent, and so he understood, you know, this is a racist incident, and so he wasn't that hard on me. He gave the kid, the other kid, attention. He basically allowed me to get scot-free, right? So I was like, oh, fair enough. Anyway, you know, it's a couple of hours later in the day, right? And this other senior senior staff member, this guy's a white guy, and he comes up to me and he takes me out of class and he's like, Akil, I can't believe he called you a paki. And he says the word. He says the word and he lets it sit in the air.
Wow.
Before it continues. Like he says it to my face. And I'm just standing there and I'm shocked, right? Because I'm thinking, first of all, you're an adult. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know that this, now, regardless of whether you think the word's offensive or not, you know that this word has had an emotional impact upon this student. And you know that that caused that student to result to physical violence. And you're going to use that word again.
Right. So did you confront him?
No, I was just shocked. And I just stayed quiet after that. Because I think that's when I realized that there's an element of, you know, that's probably the first time I experienced like me going up against the power structure. Because the thing with racism in the UK, and I think it's different to America, is that as well as us having brown people here having to experience the average racism of, oh, you look brown, and then they're racist to you. What's different to America is that there's that added layer of colonialism. You know, I am the colonized individual. I am the one that was I'm the conquered living in the conqueror's land. And, you know, there's that extra element of colonialism that, you know, goes into the education system and whatnot.
Yeah, it also sounds like it has to do with the area where you're growing up. So you're in Beckenham and you describe that you're the only Pakistani in your vicinity.
Yeah, so
it seems like you're almost being like surrounded and just being taken advantage of due to the fact that you're such a small minority that basically you don't even have a voice. Oftentimes, minorities get empowered in a place where there's more of them and they kind of come together and, you know, they decide that you can't use this word or you can't provoke me with these things, for example. But you don't have that luxury.
Yeah, so in other places like London, like Whitechapel, which is a Bengali area, or Walthamstow, which has a lot of Pakistanis, you know, you wouldn't have had this incident because, you know, there the schools, most of the students are from that demographic, right? Whereas where I was, when we first moved here, we were the only ethnic minority family in the area. Then sort of as years went by, different ethnicities moved in. So then my neighbor, who's a good friend of mine, they're from, they're of Ugandan descent, as well as Indian descent, and they live next door. Across the road from us, there's an Arab family. And, you know, slowly, more people of more ethnic minorities started moving in. But like I said, there's not that many Pakistanis in the area.
Right, right. You gave an example of Prince Harry using that word, right?
Yeah.
Well, he was Prince Harry.
He was Prince Harry. I got a lot to say about the Meghan and Harry thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, he used that word. It kind of sounded like it was a slip of the tongue, or, you know, he didn't really understand that it was derogatory. So to me, again, it comes back to that context. It's very simple. It's very simple of what's offensive and what's not offensive. Yeah. With the style of the way that they're approaching you and what they're trying to get, you know, what they're trying to achieve out of that. So when Prince Harry said it, it sounded like he was just trying to tell a story. When somebody comes to your face once again and they say any word, it doesn't have to be packing any word, right? Just to kind of provoke you or something, then it's pretty obvious that their intentions are not good, right? The N-word, of course, it has a lot of history. It has a lot more complexity around it just because you already mentioned it has a long history of, you know, oppression, slavery around it. And now, of course, it's even more complex because a lot of people use that word among the Black community as a source of empowerment. So they use it for, you know, to refer to each other.
Yeah.
So it's pretty clear. Again, using Paki over here in the U.S., not a big deal. Using it in somebody's face, even in the U.S., if somebody came to me over here and just said, hey, you Paki, I guess I would be a bit offended, even though that's never really happened before.
Yeah, I would say it's simple, right? It's like, so let's take the example of any sort of word, the N-word, the P-word, whatever, right?
Yeah.
If there is a word that is an offensive to a community, and you do not belong to that community, you have no choice in whether you get to say that word or not. You simply cannot say that word. Whereas if you belong to that community for which that word has been used against, then I believe you have a choice or whether you want to use it or whether you don't want to use it. You know, I when I see other Pakistanis or brown people say the P word, I know it's hypocritical, but I don't get offended because I understand that, you know, they have a choice to say it or not. And I'm not going to force them to use it or force them not to use it. I'm just going to respect their decision. That's how they want to handle it. That's up to them. But me personally, I don't like saying the word Paki. I don't like saying it to other Pakistanis. I don't like saying it about myself. I just stay away from that word.
Honestly, I've never even thought twice about that word before. This is the first time I think we're going really in depth about it. It's interesting because, in our usage over here, we just say Pakistani or non-Pakistani. We don't have that shortcut.
Yeah, so I sort of got, so that same teacher that called me a Paki, right? He also did this other thing. This is not really much to do with my Pakistani identity. Probably say more to do with my Muslim identity. In my English class, we were having a debate about the Iraq War. And we all sort of agreed, everyone in the classroom agreed the Iraq War should never have happened. It was just a form of colonialism of just trying to get resources, right? And then murdered a bunch of innocent people. And we all agreed that that was the thing. No one disagreed saying, oh, the Iraq War was good or whatever. Everyone agreed it was bad. However, I was the only brown kid in that class. I was the only Muslim kid in that class when we had that debate. Then about a week later, I don't know if this is by coincidence. It may just have been. But to me, given the fact this happened a week later, I'll probably say they were related somehow. That same Mr. Williams, he takes me out of class. He's like, Akil, can I talk to you for a minute? And he takes me into one like a spare classroom, and he starts discussing with me your British values. So in the UK, we have this thing called British values. There's these five values that we say you should aspire to have, right? They are democracy, rule of law, tolerance, mutual respect, and individual liberty. And these are sort of shoved down our throat, essentially. Now, I actually agree with these values. I think these values are great to have. We should always respect democracy. We should have rule of law. We should have tolerance, mutual respect, and, you know, individual liberty for everyone.
Yeah.
Where my contention is whether these are British values.
Mm-hmm.
You do any looking into British history, British politics, you know, you can see that these values are not British whatsoever, because British history has shown we do not always respect democracy, because we go and we colonize other people and say you're not allowed democracy. We don't necessarily respect rule of law, because when Grenfell happened, the people that did it and were responsible for that burning of all those innocent people, they're getting away with it. We don't respect tolerance, as we can see now with Brexit. You know, it's actually Brexit happened last night, so we're not in the EU.
Yeah,
in transition right now.
It did. And just to add some context here, Brexit was officially completed on January 31st, 2020. And this conversation with Akil was recorded the following day. So even though the UK-wide referendum for Brexit was held in June 2016, in which 52% voted to leave the European Union, this only had started a several-year-long process, which would finally complete in the end of January this year.
Yeah, mutual respect. You go to any pub in the UK, or you walk past any pub, in my experience, you know, people get shouted at for being, you know, either a Paki or they say the N-word or whatnot. It happens a lot. And then even individual liberty. You know, if I wanted to say Arabic in public, I have that right. I can say it. But then other people might get a bit offended and feel they need to call the police or whatever. It's happened, incidents happen. So, you know, these values, while they are good to have, I'll be hesitant to call them British. And, you know, from when that teacher took me to have this conversation about these are British values, he didn't go to anyone else in the class and say, I asked everyone else in the class, did you have a session with Sir about British values? No one said, well, you want about Akil? Yeah, they call me, in school, they call me Akil because they can't say Akil, but yeah, I use that as well now, basically. But yeah, they're like, what you want about Akil? Yeah, we didn't have that session with Sir. And I did. And so I kind of look back on that and I realized, you know, this wasn't just a regular conversation. We had this conversation because he was worried that me being Muslim and me talking about the Iraq War, which is actually just a political, if we're being objective here, it's really just to do with politics and resources. But obviously there's that layer of religion involved, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what his goal was. I think he was, I don't know, trying to check if I was an extremist or whatnot. But yeah, you know, I just went along with it. I was like, yeah, sir, British values are great. I knew that, you know, this was bullshit because British values are not, like I just mentioned, are not necessarily British. Yeah. I didn't want to escalate the situation. But I would say this though, like I've now moved on from that school. So when I finished my GCSEs, I left Harris Beckenham and now I go to Harris Westminster, which is in central London. And Harris Westminster has a much more mixed demographic. It's basically kids from all over London, from lower economic backgrounds, right? That, you know, don't have the income for like private education, basically are taken from all over London. We all go to central London to have our education together. You know, I meet kids from East, kids from West London, kids from East London, loads of different backgrounds, Arabs, Persians, Indians, Bengalis, Africans, you know, Jamaicans, you know. So it's very, very diverse. And so issues with race, there is definitely discussion about racism in this school, in the school I go to now, but there's an understanding that, you know, it's a problem. Yeah. But yeah. I would say racism in my new school is, I've never experienced any racism in my new school.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how much a difference in, you know, just changing your location can make in the same country. But, you know, I've interviewed various people throughout this podcast from the UK, and you're the first one who's actually described so much troubles in school regarding your background in this day and age, you know, in this year. You know, it's amazing how, you know, your city, your location can matter so much.
Yeah. Just sort of one more thing. I didn't fully accept my brown identity until I started doing the research into brown history, which was triggered by my grandparents staying over in our house for a year. During this time, we regularly watched Pakistani news on a regular basis. And this was during the last election. This is when Imran Khan got elected. And so our house was buzzing. We were like really into all the Pakistani politics because, you know, Imran Khan and all that, yeah? And that was probably where the switch happened for me, where I started realizing, oh, this is actually quite interesting. And so, you know, I did my digging, I looked into history, read loads of books, you know, about South, not just Pakistani history, but South Asian history as a whole. And I kind of gained that appreciation because now I have an appreciation for, I don't know, the blood that runs in my veins, you could say. Whereas in the British education system, I didn't, because I was only taught about, oh, this is King Richard III or whatever, or Henry VIII or whatnot. And I never felt an emotional connection, that history. And we were taught that, oh, this is like, these people were great and whatnot. And I never heard about great brown people, hence the self-hatred, I guess. But it wasn't until obviously I learned about brown people that I finally realized we're just as great as any people on the planet, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So let's keep moving. Let's talk about your family. You mentioned a younger brother, you mentioned yourself, you mentioned an older brother, and you mentioned a sister. So how many siblings do you have?
Yeah, so there's my mom, my dad, I have an older brother, an older sister, then me and my younger brother. So there's like three siblings, there's four of us kids.
How big is the age gap?
Yeah, so between my older sister is like a sort of a year and a half age gap. Between me and my younger brother, there's like a year and a half age gap. And then between me and my sister, I think it's about 5-6 years.
I see. Okay. So then you mentioned about how the government kind of placed you in Beckenham due to your older brother's disability.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that. Talk about your older brother. Give a little bit of background on him.
Yeah. So my older brother has a disability. So my older brother is 24 years old. He was born in 1995. Mm-hmm. And he has a disability called limb girdle muscular dystrophy. Now, if you don't know what that is, muscular dystrophy is essentially where the muscles in your body become progressively weaker over time. They're essentially eating themselves away, you could say. And that only affects his limbs, so his arms and his legs and his girdle, which is like his torso, right?
I see.
In terms of mentally, he's just like, you know, he's perfectly mentally functioning. He's actually quite smart as well, and he likes to take the piss out of me quite a bit, you know. So he was able to walk up until the age of 9. After he turned 9, he had to use a wheelchair constantly, and he still does use an electric wheelchair. And then he stopped being able to feed himself when he was 15, so sort of 2010. And I've seen, I guess, the deterioration over time, in the sense that, You know, like for example, Xbox, right? He has an he used to be able to play Xbox. He used to be able to use the triggers on the back, the thumbsticks and the buttons. The first thing he wasn't able to use anymore were the triggers on the back. He wasn't able to use the triggers anymore. About a year passed until he wasn't able to use, I guess, the buttons. And then another year passed until he just wasn't able to play it altogether. And so I think that's sort of the best illustration for me of how I sort of see the deterioration happening.
I see. And now he's 24.
Yeah, this started ever since he was born, this deterioration.
Yeah, but he could walk up until he was 9.
Yeah, he could walk up until 9.
I see. Otherwise, you mentioned, of course, in other ways, he's absolutely functional. So is he going to school? Is he doing anything else on the side?
Yeah, so my older brother, he's finished school now. He wasn't able to go to university for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And then he went to college and he did a college course there. Now he works as a recruitment consultant for this company called TAP, which is basically short for the Ability People. And this company was set up by Liz Johnson and her business partner. And they set up this company. Essentially, the goal of it is to make the workplace more accessible for disabled people. Because in the UK, right, in the last 30 years, despite government initiatives and whatnot, the number of disabled people in the workplace has just stayed the same. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't because disabled people don't want to work. In fact, disabled people do want to work, you know? Disabled people, by them being disabled, means that they tend to stay in education longer, end up gaining all these qualifications, but because no one wants to hire a disabled person or doesn't know how to accommodate a disabled person, you know, they never get a job. And so that's where my brother comes in, where he sort of does both ends of the work. For example, he has disabled people that he works with to try and get them a job. And so he sort of talks to them about what it's like, admissions process is going to be, how the workplace functions and whatnot, sort of getting ready for work life.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, he consults with big businesses. So for example, right now he's working with HSBC, technology department. He's working with their department to sort of make that department more accessible, that admissions process more accessible to disabled people. Because like, for example, with today, now when you want to get a job, you have to do like these tests on like the computer or whatnot, right? These tests essentially want to check if you have A, B, and C. But often these tests, a disabled person may have A, B, and C, but the test prevents them from displaying that they have A, B, and C. For example, there's like this one type of test where it's like they record you, a question comes up on the screen and you have a time limit on to answer that question. And for someone that perhaps has autism or someone that perhaps has a speech impediment, that can be quite difficult. Because it means that they are now forced under time pressure to answer that question, right? And they may have the right answer to the question, but simply by the process being the way it is, they are now essentially prevented from getting that job.
Right.
And so my brother goes to the companies, he's like, this is what you need to do to improve. And then he makes sure that they do it.
Wow. Yeah, that's fantastic. So for most days, does he actually go into an office or does he also work from home?
Yeah, so most of the time he works from home. His boss, he calls the people he's working with on the phone to sort of get things done. And then sometimes he goes to places, he goes to the meetings. In fact, I've been with some of the meetings with him. So I've been to HSBC and I sit there and I just take notes in the meeting. I went to this other company, Reddington, and I met their CEO, right? So I get to go to all these sort of corporate business meetings and whatnot and just sit in and listen and see everything happening. So it's pretty cool for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I've worked for various companies and many were companies that I worked at, I would see during orientation or day-to-day work life. There's quite a few disabled people who are employed by various companies throughout here. And so the law kind of also, I think it's the same in the UK as well. The law, you know, it's illegal to discriminate against any individual for disability, as long as they're qualified for the job, of course, you know. And they can perform all the kind of the functions that are required by the job. I mean, there's probably a little bit of discrimination, I'm sure, or a lot of discrimination that happens regardless by employers, but at least it's illegal to do that. It's good that at least we have some initiative, right? Compared to a lot of other countries, at least there's some initiatives or some effort being done to employ you know, disabled people, because like you mentioned, they do want to work, they do want to be productive, of course, just like anybody else.
Yeah, I would probably just sort of clarify the statement that while discrimination does happen, I think it's more less to do with discrimination and more to do with employers just don't know how. They don't know how to get a disabled person into the workplace. They don't know what they need to do. They don't know the process that it takes. They don't know how to accommodate a disabled person, whatnot. You know, I think that's sort of where, I guess, British society kind of fails, in the sense that while we have the regulations, we have the laws, we have the government initiatives to get disabled people into work, I think the actual practicality, kind of finding solutions, to easy problems like, oh, this person's in a wheelchair and we don't have a ramp to get him into the building. Oh, I guess he just can't come into the building now. Yeah. That, you know, in the UK, most buildings are sort of have ramps and are disability access. But let's say I'll move my brother and we turn up to a building and we want to go into like this restaurant, and then the restaurant doesn't have a ramp to get him inside. That's it. We can't go inside. There's no way around it. Whereas I think this is actually an example of what happened in Pakistan. When I was last in Pakistan, we were met with that situation where, because obviously Pakistan, but you know, it's still developing, so they don't have disability access everywhere. But you know, we were there outside this building that didn't have a ramp, and there was no way for us to get in. But the difference was this: that we were standing outside, and there's an obvious problem. And then these like 6-7 Pakistani guys just on the street saw the situation. They're like, "Oh, you know what? We're gonna help you." And so they all get around my older brother. And they pick up his wheelchair. Now, my older brother's wheelchair is like a heavy electric wheelchair. Yeah, it weighs like a ton. Like, it's really heavy. So these 8 guys, they pick up his wheelchair and carry him into the building. And then afterwards, when we were leaving, the same people or other people came and helped lifted him up. I think that's the difference between the UK and the Pakistan. What the UK lacks in practical solutions, but has in regulations and whatnot. Pakistan has the practical solutions, but doesn't have the regulation or the initiatives. And that's the big difference.
Yeah, that's a good story, actually. Because, there's a lot of people who are standing by in Pakistan who are, you know, willing to help. And when this type of stuff happens, that's amazing.
Yeah, but you wouldn't get that in the UK.
Yeah, not as much, because the expectation is that over in the UK or in the US, like, they probably have building access somewhere. You know, there's probably a ramp somewhere.
Yeah.
Or he probably has help somewhere else. There's a lot of privatism. People are very, you know, reluctant to help sometimes.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
In Pakistan, I'm not very educated on the treatment of disabled people outside of the, you know, outside of their own family members kind of taking care of them, meaning are there employment initiatives for them, things like that. So
yeah,
overall, do you think your brother is doing well in the UK?
Yeah, I think he's doing great. The UK healthcare system, our beloved NHS, is like the best in the world.
Yeah,
I know in America, it's quite weird that you have to pay for healthcare.
Yeah.
I guess it's something we take for granted here, in the sense that we don't have to worry about my brother's, if anything serious happens to my older brother in terms of his health, we always have the NHS or the healthcare system to fall back on.
Right.
Which in Pakistan, you wouldn't have, which here we do have. And I would also say, like, my older brother, you know, if you don't know a disabled person, when you look at someone with disability, the first thing you do is you feel sorry for them. And that's understandable, because you don't understand how disabled people live their lives or what their outlook is, right? I'll probably say my older brother is very, very positive. He's very, very like, yeah, I may not be able to walk or whatnot. He accepts his situation. He accepts it, but then he knows that, okay, so what if I'm disabled? I'm going to go and, you know, work and help start a company that helps disabled people get into work, you know? He goes out of his ways to do things. He's a public speaker. He's a trustee for Panathlon Challenge, which is a charity that helps disabled people get involved in sports and whatnot. And so, you know, he doesn't let his disability be an excuse, as you could say. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He's a very strong individual, I would say.
You know, hearing this story from you makes it, even though it's personal for you, but the fact that you and I kind of know each other at this point, right? It's pretty heartwarming for me, because I don't encounter people of disability day to day, especially among our own Pakistani folks. So, you know, I hear about them. I hear about a lot of my relatives and extended relatives in Pakistan, you know, going through some sort of disability, and they don't have the provisions over there or any governmental assistance over there to take care of them. So it's pretty sad to hear that. But then, you know, over here, it's great that at least that's one aspect where I think a lot of other countries, a lot of other people can strive towards that. Hey, this is kind of being done. You know, it's working out really well in certain countries. So there are a lot of positives to living here as well.
Yeah, there's definitely,
you know, putting aside the racism and all that.
Yeah, 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 the racism. Yeah, you know, there's often a talk of, I guess, you know, privilege. Yeah, you know, white privilege, and mm-hmm. you know what is privilege? I would say I'm privileged to be living in the UK. I'm privileged to be getting the kind of education I'm getting. I would say I'm even privileged to have a disabled brother. It sounds selfish, but for me, it's great, because if I want to skip a line, I'll be like, yo, bruv, let's go. Yeah. And, you know, as well as on top of that, I would say by my brother being disabled, yeah, I think as a family, I say we're a lot more close than most other Pakistani or South Asian families are.
Yeah.
In a sense that my parents are always, my dad's always home because he's a carer for my older brother. Yeah. So if I need anything from my dad, I need to tell my dad anything. He's there. He's available. I can go talk to him. Had my brother not been disabled, my dad would be working and I would never know the man, you know?
Yeah.
So there's always a silver lining to these situations. My older brother even told me when I asked him one time, are you angry at God are you angry at Allah for putting you in this situation? And he turned around and he said to me, you know, for a long time, I was very angry at the world. I was very angry at my parents. I was very angry at God. But then, you know, as he got older, he realized that, you know, as much as though it seems like it's a curse, he said that, this is his words, he said, it's a blessing for me because it means that Allah has put me in a situation where I cannot go and commit major sins. You know, if I wanted to go murder someone, God has removed that from me. So if I get angry, I know no matter what, I won't hurt anyone. Yeah?
Right.
You know, things like that.
Yeah, people often refer to these as blessings in disguise, meaning people often refer to it that way, like something that's happened to you, but in reality, it might be a blessing in another way. You mentioned how it brought your family closer together, allowed your brother to understand what are things that he can control and what are things that he cannot control. So what are things that he can control? He can actually get employed. He can actually have, you know, more or less a regular working lifestyle as anybody else, provided there's a few limitations, right? And so understanding what is in God's hands and what is in your control, and taking control of the things that at least are available to you, right? That can be very empowering to some people. Otherwise, it's not just about your brother, but it's about a general rule of life. People, one of the reasons why anxiety is so high in our world today is because people start, you know, getting worried about things that they cannot control all the time. You know, there are certain things that you can control, but there are certain things that you cannot. And once you get a grasp of, I guess, what is available to you, meaning what are the tools that God has provided to you that you can work with, and you start putting those to use, there's surprisingly a lot you can get done.
Yeah, I'll probably say,
and I guess still a lot that you can be thankful for.
Yeah, there's always something you can be thankful for, because, you know, God can take and God can give. You know, that's how I see it.
Yeah.
God can take things from you, but he can also give you many things as well. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't want to say that by my brother being spiritual, that's how he's managed to get this far, but I would say that his belief in God has, I think, helped him handle the situation better than had he had no belief in anything, you know?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
I think, you know, in one of your other podcasts, you're talking about, you know, depression and anxiety within the Desi community.
Yeah.
Yeah, the lady on there, she said that, you know, just believing in something bigger than you are can help a lot in these kind of situations. And so I think that's definitely, and I see that with my older brother, you know?
Yeah, yeah. She also talked extensively about how, you know, mental health specifically in that case, which is obviously a little different, but she was just talking about how, why people avoid discussing mental health in our culture. And I guess disability is a thing that people are more open to discussing in Pakistan and among Pakistani culture, but it's something that we don't discuss enough, I guess, unless it affects us. You know, like when I went to Pakistan, I would see disabled people on the streets. You know, there's like nobody to take care of them.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
So that's heartbreaking because you shared a story about how people helped you and your brother. You know, he lifted his wheelchair up the platform and, you know, you guys were able to get into a building. But then there's also a lot of other cases, and it's not just a Pakistani thing. I think it's just human nature where people just see some things that are, you know, not directly affecting them, but they are unfortunate regardless. But then all they can do is just walk by because everybody has something going on in their own lives and they feel like somebody else should be helping.
Yeah, I think from my experience, but like I said, you know, my exposure to the deaf community has been very limited because it's only with my family, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say Pakistani culture is very, just in general, when it comes to helping people, Pakistanis can be very, very helpful and often go beyond like lengths that a Gora here would never go to for anyone, yeah? Not because they're bad, but because it's just not what they do, you know? But I would also say that, so I was having a conversation with my dad the other day. It was sort of talking about like, I guess you could call it bind politics, yeah? Like politics of the village or whatnot, yeah? And in a rural setting, in sort of rural Pakistan, which is like where my parents are from, they come from like the village, right? So he was saying that had he stayed in Pakistan and had my older brother been disabled there and would be in this situation in Pakistan, our lives would probably not be as good as they are. Because in a rural setting, if your eldest son is disabled, it's seen as a weakness, you know?
Hmm.
It's seen as though, oh, this man here has a disabled child. That means that if we do anything to him or take advantage of him, there's going to be no consequences, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my dad was sort of explaining that to me. So it was, so while in some aspects there is a human empathy, sympathy sort of connection, there is also an element of, I don't want to say Pakistani culture because this is a thing that is universal. You know, this is a thing that happens, this idea of weakness and seeing people that are weak and taking advantage of them. It's not just a Pakistani thing. It happens in all developing nations. It used to happen in the UK as well. Yeah. You know, it happened in Sparta. They would throw a disabled child, you know, off a cliff. It's not just Pakistan, but I think it's just the developing world in general still has a long way to go when it comes to making, you know, a system that provides, you know, a good welfare system, basically.
A good welfare system. Yeah, you're absolutely right. This concludes.
Yeah, also, one last thing.
Sorry, I just felt like throwing that in there. Here's one more thing from Akil.
I sort of told my family about this, and my older brother actually, I asked him if he would want to go on the show. And so he says, you know, if you want to talk to him more about being disabled in general, you can, you know, if you want to, you know, he'll be willing to have a talk. So, you know.
Actually, yeah, that might be a good idea.
You know, and then once you've interviewed my older brother, you can interview my younger brother and my sister. And before you know it, you would have interviewed my entire family.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole Ghani family.
Yeah, the whole Ghani family. Yeah, the whole Khandan will be on Pakcord.
Yeah, yeah. No, but no, I definitely want to talk to your brother. That's a good idea.
Yeah. I'll give you his contact details. And yeah, we can move forward from there.
What's his name, by the way?
Adil.
Adil, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so enjoy your evening with your wife. Have a nice evening.
You too.
I haven't got a wife yet, so...
Yeah, with your family.
With our family, yeah. But enjoy your evening. And I really enjoyed this. Thank you for giving me your time.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I'll see you later.
See ya.
Take care.
Bye.
Yeah. So there you have it. Now I will try to practice my narrator voice one more time. This concludes our conversation with Akil. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Next episode, we'll talk to Akil's older brother, Adil, to hear about his perspective and life from his angle. I hope you enjoy this chat. We'll see you next time. Needs a little work.